Indeed, there was not much left worth experiencing. My friends had all gone, or they were no longer my friends. Sometimes I got postcards with foreign stamps. There were occasional letters from Frank Landau. These letters became gloomier as time went by. At first they sounded decisive and hopeful, then they became shorter and more ambiguous, and once, in the middle of August, there was a veritable bundle of a letter, 12 or 14 pages, written as they came to mind, like a soliloquy. The tone was tired and despondent, even desperate. It was all no good. Things had gone as badly as possible with Ellen, and they were going to part. There were no opportunities for Frank in Switzerland, nothing on the horizon after his doctorate. He could not forget Hanny and our talks. There was nothing to replace what he had left behind, nothing to connect with the past that might give him strength. I'm not writing this to ask for your advice, because I know there is none. A little later Ellen suddenly came back. She simply appeared. The relationship was over. She had capitulated. She wrote to me, and I visited her 2 or 3 times in Wannsee, sat with mixed feelings in the garden of the house I had been in on April 1st. She wanted me to explain it all to her and give her solace and advice. She was in a bad state, confused and off balance. She loved Frank, but she no longer thought she could live with him. It had all been terribly hasty, and now it was spoiled forever. If only they had had time to let things develop slowly and see where they were leading. But that was the terrible thing. Everything always had to be decided immediately. You stood at so many crossroads. Here and now you had to make up your mind, and the roads led in such different directions, toward an unknowable future. Her family was preparing to emigrate to America. Should she go with them? That would mean never seeing Frank again. Should she go back to Zurich? That meant tying herself to him permanently, and this summer had not been propitious. But she loved him. You know him. Tell me what he's really like. Tell me what to do. I had spoken to Hanny at the beginning of April. She had lain in a darkened room for a few days, eating nothing and crying all day. Later we had traipsed from one consulate to the next, written letters to various Czech ministries, and had interviews at police stations. It had all been to no avail. The question of her nationality was hopelessly tangled. Hanny was a prisoner in Germany. I led a strange existence, almost like being a receiver in charge of a bankrupt life. Between times I did the preparatory tests for a certificate that meant nothing to me and that belonged more to that bankrupt life, which had once been my own. Also, between times I wrote newspaper articles, little things with as much bitter wit as I could muster, and was surprised to see them in print a few days later in that slightly schizophrenic paper with its enforced, stolid Nazi opinions, a paper that had had an international reputation only a few months ago. How proud I would have been to belong to it then. Now it was of little concern to me. It was temporary, and did not count. Of all the people I had been close to, only Charlie remained. Strangely enough, since it had started as a carnival fling, she stayed. She wandered like a silken thread through the weave of that unreal summer, a slightly painful, not quite happy love affair, but still a love affair with a little sweetness. She was a good, simple, young Berlin girl, and in happier times our story might have been simple, trite, and sweet. As it was, misfortune bound us more tightly together than was good for us, and demanded more of us than we were able to give each other. Namely, to be precise, compensation for the loss of a whole world, and for daily painful, choking distress. That was too much for both of us. I could hardly bear to speak to her about what was going on inside me. After all, her own position was much worse and much more dangerous, more immediate, more urgent. She was Jewish. She was persecuted. She was in daily fear for her life and that of her parents and the large family she belonged to, and to which she was very close. So many terrible things were happening to the Jews, but I had difficulty telling them all apart. Like many other young Jews, she considered what was happening to them almost to the exclusion of all else, and who can blame her? She reacted in all innocence, becoming a Zionist from one day to the next, a Jewish nationalist. It was a common reaction, and one that I could sympathize with, but observed with regret. It so closely followed the Nazis' intentions. It contained so much weak-hearted acceptance of their hostile assumptions. If I had argued with her, I would have robbed her of her only consolation.
"But, Peter,"
"What are we to do?" she asked, with large, sad eyes, the one time I tried, as gently as I could, to hint at my scepticism. She studied Hebrew and thought about Palestine, but she had not arrived there yet. She still went to work in a store. It had been reallowed, but who knew for how long, and helped to feed her family. She was touchingly caring about her father, and all her relatives went to work and suffered. She lost weight and cried a great deal, but sometimes she let me comfort her and laughed again, at least for one evening. Then she would be charmingly silly and boisterous, but it did not last long. In August she became seriously ill, and she had her appendix removed. That was the second time that year that I saw appendicitis apparently caused by mental stress. All the while we continued our little affair as well as we could. We went to the cinema and drank wine together, tried to be merry and in love in the normal way. We parted late at night. I took the last subway from her distant part of town to mine, and sat around on empty platforms where the only movement was the escalators. On Sundays we often went for walks in the woods, or lay around by the water's edge or in some clearing. Berlin's surroundings are beautiful, rather untamed and wild. Even within the range of the suburban railway you can, if you leave the well-trodden excursion routes, still reach areas that seem untouched, magnificently lonely, unchangeable, and romantically sad. We searched them out and wandered down long alleys of dark green firs, or we lay in a meadow beneath a threateningly blue sky. The sky was beautiful, and so were the long, densely packed rows of tall trees, the grass, the moss, the ants, and the buzzing summer insects. It was all infinitely, lethally soothing. Only we should not have been part of the picture. Without us, it would have been even more beautiful. We were intruders. That summer the weather was wonderful, the sun tireless, and an ironic god arranged that 1933 of all years would be a vintage of which connoisseurs of wine would speak with reverence for many years.